Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 26th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Steve Gramsch. Today's session number is GRS 2001-04, and it's titled Faith in Science. This is my father's world. Let's listen in.
Well, I guess I can get started. Yesterday, one of the things that came out of our discussion was the, a good sort of spectrum of views about various controversies that tend to challenge us often as Christians to make a choice. Often, I mean, it doesn't have to be that way, but make a choice between a biblical story and a story that appears to be consistent with good science. And we there are a number of these, but most importantly, I think, are the age of the earth, sort of how our geological landforms and things like rock strata and mountains and rivers and have formed, and also, of course, the appearance of life and evolutionary process. I might point out that several of the people who I work with are working quite actively in this area of the origin of life. And starting from the point of view of building up complex molecules, so for example, what sort of conditions were there to create proteins? And one of the most famous examples of this, in this experimental type of approach, was the experiment done, I believe it was in the late 30s, by Harold Urey, who assumed from the rock record what the atmosphere was in the primordial Earth. Contained a lot of methane, not very much oxygen, and so he made an educated guess as to the composition of this atmosphere, put it in an enclosed chamber, and then ran a spark through it to simulate a lightning strike. And lo and behold, what he got out of that was amino acids, which, of course, as we know, are the building blocks of proteins. And then, of course, if you have proteins, then you can build more complex molecules from that. And so that view has been overturned in the intervening years in terms of the composition of the atmosphere. But the same sort of approach is being pursued quite actively by a number of groups. And one of those happens to be in Washington. And at the geophysical lab, the approach they're taking is more along the lines of what sort of processes take place in these deep sea hydrothermal vents, where they've discovered that life itself, sort of what we call life, is not necessarily intelligent life, but what we might call self-replicating life, really requires very little. It requires some source of chemical energy and somewhere to attach, and that's about it. And so life, evidence for life, as we know from the current press, evidence for that has been found on Mars. It's not conclusive, but evidence has been found on Mars or in places as inhospitable as the Antarctic. And so it really kind of stretches the mind to think about life in those terms. But One of the interesting things is about these deep sea hydrothermal vents is the extreme conditions that apparently favor the formation of these molecules, these protein molecules. And so what they're doing, and they've shown this, is that there appears to be the conditions appropriate for the synthesis of complex molecules in these environments. These deep sea hydrothermal vents have temperatures up above 500 degrees Celsius, so 700 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. And something like that. And then also very high pressures. Pressures that, for example, we would not be able to survive. I mean, these are the pressures at the bottom of the ocean, basically. And it's we all know that if we try to dive down there without sort of the proper equipment, or even if we do have the proper equipment, it still is very, very difficult for a human being or other large-scale mammal to survive down there. I mean, it's very difficult. However, there are organisms that thrive in that environment. What was that kind of fish, Thomas? The thing, the fish that has the light in front of its head? What was that fish? Anyway, they survive down there where there's no light. There's no, apparently, extreme cold temperatures. And then you go into these deep sea hydrothermal vents, which are very, very warm, have what we would consider extremely inhospitable atmospheres, sulfide gases pouring out of these things. It really kind of stretches the imagination to think along these lines. I personally don't pursue that kind of work, but one can't help but be amazed, really, I think, at the sort of progress they're making. One of the things I left unfinished yesterday was a question for you, and that is, and again, I want to emphasize the fact that this is kind of a new endeavor for me, and one of the things that's helpful is to find out what people really think about this. I mean, you can read all the literature, and you can sort of go into the technical journals and get the lowdown on the current research, but if you're starting to talk about faith, then it becomes a quite different matter. And one of the things that I'm interested in is your opinion on why it appears to be so uncomfortable for many people to accept a scientific explanation of the natural world, whether it's the creation or the age of the earth, while at the same time people will willingly take medicines developed using the same approach. I mean, you go to, you have an illness or something, I mean, even a headache or something, and you'll take an aspirin. Or you will go and have major surgery. If the doctor says, you need major surgery, then you'll go ahead and have major surgery. Now, these surgical procedures, it appears to me, are developed in the same way. I mean, there's trial and error. Almost all these surgical procedures are tried out on animals before they're tried out on human beings. And so why is it? Is that a silly question? Do you think? Yeah.
Well, I don't think they see the connection. I mean, it almost took me a minute to understand the connection when you were explaining it. So, I mean, I don't think they see that there's any... You're talking about apples and oranges. I think if you were to explain it to someone that way.
I think that maybe people think it's black and white. Mm-hmm. Either you do believe or you don't, and that there's no middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that they're afraid that you stretch to believe that maybe God created the earth in a different way than we were taught to believe.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe that's wavering, in their own faith.
So is medicine an art rather than a science?
No, I think it's they say it's an art. I mean, a science and an art both, which mm-hmm. is, you know, what I believe. But so if you were to make that analogy to someone, let's say, who's a fundamentalist, they would look at you and say, well, so, that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, of course you're going to have trial and error, but you have trial and error in everything. You mm-hmm. know, building a house, you know, frying an egg, you know. And everything you do is through trial and error, so why is that? But, you know, this is the way the earth was created. I just wouldn't think they'd see the connection.
Yeah.
Yes, question, Steve. If you take a literalist, one of them believe literally in the Bible and what the Scripture says,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me they have a closed mind, there's no room for anything else. While science generally try to keep it open mind.
Right.
There's that difference.
Right. Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I mean, I guess we all have our own construction about how we put, and it may be different for everyone, how we put in place our understanding of the creation or the appearance of life on Earth based on the faith that we have. And I guess... And here's another thing that I have not been able to put into place in my own thinking, and that's simply because I haven't traveled very much. I've been to Germany a couple times and Italy once, but for scientific conferences, and haven't had the leisure time to sort of explore and get a feeling for how people thought. Other responsibilities have kept me from that, but we don't, at least it seems to me, that we don't necessarily hear these debates being waged so vociferously in other countries. Am I wrong about that? I really want to know.
I don't know.
Does anybody have any idea about that? Maybe we should all go over there and ask Dave. But I don't know. And so that was the question that I had. And if we can't answer it, then I'll, you know, have to go and try to find it out. But I don't know that we can find the equivalent of, maybe we can, but the Scopes monkey trial in, let's say, Sweden. You know? I don't know, and I think that's relevant. I think it's relevant to the social atmosphere in our country, because the same sort of thinking that we saw in the 19th century is going on now. Despite the fact that we have more advances in knowledge, and you know, you have certain groups of people who are fighting against the advancements of science, you know, that don't want to hear about it. As you say, they're just completely separate, and that, you know, they're not going to meet anywhere, and so people will think about the fossil record as something completely other than the science that it is, which to me is mind-boggling. I mean, you know, if we do good science and we say that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, then how do we account for the creation story of Genesis? How do you account?
Yeah, well, if you like I mentioned the day before, I had lived with some Mormons for a while. And very, you know, very intelligent, and scientists. Scientists. And so they could go along the scientific route for what it is they were doing, you know, and some of them were physicians. And so they followed the scientific method. But, you know, when it came to their faith, you know, if the Latter-day Saint that had the current connection with God, whoever's giving the orders at the time, that's what he said.
That's it.
We don't discuss it anymore.
Right.
You know, and that was, and that's not scientific, but they separated the two worlds
Yeah. Well, as I said, I have a lot to learn about this, and that question is in particular is one that I need to pursue because I think it's relevant to what we're discussing. But what I want to do today is talk a little bit about a couple of ways in which I see, as a scientist, the hand of the Creator at work. One can understand this scientifically. One can understand all of the basic science that goes into these models that I'm going to just illustrate for you briefly. But at the same time, you wind up realizing in the end that there has to be some intelligence behind it. And growing up as a Christian in the Lutheran Church, that connection to the Creator setting this science in motion seems natural to me. And that's one of the things that upsets me. That aspect doesn't upset me, but what upsets me is that this connection seems natural to me and, you know, someday I hope to my children. But yet we live, at least I live, in a state where that those scientific principles are constantly being embattled by public school districts. And to me, that's not funny. To a lot of people, I think it's funny, maybe, who live in very, very metropolitan areas that are very different from the state of Virginia. As we talked about yesterday, the state of Virginia is almost cut in half in its sort of cosmopolitan attitude about how science is to be taught in the public schools. But despite the cosmopolitan nature of Northern Virginia, there's still this rumbling that one ought to just make sure that we say that the theory of evolution is a very controversial theory. And also that we ought to talk about the age of the earth and give creation science equal time. Well, of course, this has been, time and time again, it's been turned down by, you know, high courts in the United States. But this rumbling takes place. And as I said, I don't find it funny at all. But,
Steve, you're saying the theory of evolution is a very controversial... I mean, are they making it controversial, or am I missing something?
What people are saying and have said for some time is that the theory of evolution ought to be taught with a disclaimer. That it is a controversial theory and that all of the pieces are not in place. And we start teaching science, and biological science in particular, to children when they're pretty young. Personally, I don't know exactly when evolutionary biology begins in the current curriculum.
Usually ninth grade.
Ninth grade. And I think that's fairly standard throughout the country in general to teach biology to ninth graders. And so that's what I'm saying. Personally, I'm not saying it's controversial. I mean, to me, it makes sense. In a sort of an overarching sense, yes, it is controversial because so many people discuss it and debate it and everything. Personally, I don't find it troublesome. But, I must confess that this week I'm exploring the reasons why I don't find it controversial, which is good, I guess. But anyway, in my opinion, there are many ways for the Christian, or not necessarily a Christian, a person of religious faith, the hand of the Creator is evident. And we sit amongst, here in this place, we sit amongst some of the most wonderful, spectacular natural scenery in the entire world. And to the person with their sights fixed at least you know, partially on the eternal. I mean, we live in a temporal world, obviously, but we as people of faith tend to think towards the eternal. It seems obvious that these aspects of nature, the mountains, the stars in the sky, the infinity of space, for example, from those big, what we call macroscopic effects to, for me, the highly organized nature of the atomic nucleus, principles of symmetry, order, and intelligence are obvious to the investigator, whether you're a scientific investigator or a casual observer. And one of the examples that I'd like to show you about that, how I, one of the things that is amazing to me, and that is the structure of the Earth's interior. Now, most of you will probably have encountered this at one time or another in your life, but I'd just like to point out a couple of things. This is the so-called preliminary Earth reference model, and what I'd like you to pay attention to is the picture on the left, first of all, and how that picture is developed is what we have as seismological data on the right, and I don't want to get into that, but what we do is measure the speed of waves through the Earth at various points on its surface and calculate those speeds and correlate them with density. The speed of the wave through the Earth is directly related to the density, and it's clear from this, the big heavy line is the density. These are two different types of wave velocities that we measure in seismology. And so it's very, very clear that these anomalies that we see, sort of these hitches in the data, are directly related to strata throughout the Earth's structure from the crust to the core. And by strata, you can look out, for example, in the Grand Canyon, and all of that is what we call crustal. That's this very, very thin layer of different sediments or different strata being laid down over millions of years. Incidentally, creationists and what's the so-called flood geology suggest that all of those strata were laid down within the year after the 40 days and 40 nights of rain. And that's certainly not the most implausible of their conclusions, but certainly one of the most spectacular. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. But anyway, the thing that I want to point out here and the chemical formulae of these various structures I haven't put in, except to say that as we move from the crust, you can go out into the mine tailings out there and take a look at the rocks. And in many of them, you'll see extremely complex assemblages of, I mean, if you're lucky, you'll see a nice piece of native copper embedded in a rock or something like that. But you'll see very complex assemblages of minerals in there, different compositions that are obvious when you look at the rocks. What happens as we move higher in pressure and temperature towards the center of the Earth is that these materials get less and less complicated. With pressure and temperature, the olivine, pyroxene, and garnet falls apart into a much simpler form of mineral that we call perovskite. These boundaries here between, say, the upper mantle and the lower mantle are indicative of those components breaking down into simpler materials. And that gives us the signature here, the seismological signature that we actually see in our data. So you ask me, well, how do you know that? Well, the way we know it is that we can simulate these conditions in the laboratory. We certainly can't go down there and see it. And if we do see things that come up from the deep earth, we have to treat that with skepticism because we don't know whether it actually reflects what's really down there or whether it reflects the conditions under which it's been sitting for some millions of years. So we have to take that with a certain amount of caution. But what we can do is simulate these through ingenious experiments in the laboratory, really, the conditions here, and with tools at our disposal, model the pressure and temperature of the Earth as we move higher and higher in pressure. And we have succeeded, actually, in reaching the outer core, inner core boundary. We do not have the technology yet to subject a solid sample to inner core pressures and temperatures at this point. We do have the outer core, inner core boundary. And one of the remarkable questions that is a very open question right now in geophysics is, what is the nature of this iron that we find in the inner core? And one of the current theories is that it is a solid, single, perfect crystal of iron that has floated amongst this liquid outer core. So it's kind of like an ice cube in a glass of water floating around and moving. And we know that iron is a magnet, and so its magnetic signature is found in the rocks of the lower mantle, the upper mantle, and the crust. And so we can tell from that information how the Earth's magnetic pole has wandered over the past tens of millions of years. So it's quite an interesting exercise.
But is that Steve or equivalent? What's the radius of that iron sphere?
Well, what we're saying here is the distance in kilometers is to the center of the Earth is about 6,000 kilometers.
And is that boundary you're talking about is
about 5,000 kilometers from the outer core to the inner core is about 5,000 kilometers. So we have a huge, nice profile. These numbers over here are millions of atmospheres of pressure. And so it's these numbers are just astronomical, and it doesn't really make too much sense to even talk about them, except to say that the pressure of the Earth is so large that it is able, according to what we've been able to see so far in our experiments, is that it is so large that it is able to take a huge ball of iron, a thousand kilometers, a million meters in radius, and organize it into a perfect crystal. Now, and that hypothesis goes a long way toward explaining some of the features that we see in rocks on the surface. And so,
this is all liquid, and in the center is solid.
This is liquid here, and the solid is here. And so you're asking me. Well, it's not unusual if you actually go and do the thermodynamics. What happens here is that the pressure overtakes the temperature. So you would think that, okay, well, it's liquid here. It's hotter in here, so it should still be liquid.
Yeah.
But the pressure gradient is so high at these depths that it overcomes the temperature and still makes it a solid.
Huh. Okay.
And that, again, gives us, we get that information from this seismological data. To give you an indication of the difference, though, iron at the inner core of the Earth is about twice as dense as it is on the surface. So if you take a piece of iron, a basic metal somewhere, and take, let's say, a ball like this, at the center of the Earth, that is shrunk down into half of its volume, essentially.
It's a perfect crystal.
Part of the reason, but basically just because of the pressure. It's just so huge in there. Now, to me, you know, I can sit back and I can read this and I can look at it and I can say to myself, you know, this is really interesting. It's very, very a beautiful piece of science. It's wonderful in its simplicity, which is one of the hallmarks of an elegant and good scientific theory, is that it's simple. And that it explains things, it explains experimental data, everything's just wonderful. But then, if you step back from the science for a moment and look at what really, how magnificent and that model is, you can't help but imagine I don't know how to explain it, but I just feel like there is that intelligence out there is just so marvelous that, you know, Genesis 1 and 2 does not explain this. You know, and one is not going to get it out of there no matter how hard you try. But, and so there's a leap that one has to make. There's a leap that one has to make to say, yes, there is that intelligence behind this, and as a person who has faith in a creator, it's almost a natural leap to make that it's such a beautiful, perfect model that explains so much. There is that intelligence behind it, but the deeper issue, I think, is that I think something like this allows one to appreciate that design, appreciate that, and really wonder about it too. So anyway, this is part of a talk that I give to collegiate students on, you know, why it's interesting to study high pressure chemistry. You know, people, undergraduates are fond of asking you, why should I do that? Especially if it's not going to, you know, result in a great salary in the end. But anyway, that's one example. What I'd like to do is just open it up and ask, what sort of examples do you have that in the natural world where, I mean, certainly they're not have to be backed up by scientific data or anything, but what is out there for you that shows you that kind of intelligence out there? I mean, it could be anything. It could be anything in the natural world or the scientific world, but I'd be interested in hearing about what it is for you that is elegant and poetic in its construction.
Yeah. I'd say it's the structure of the DNA molecule.
Yeah.
The alternating machines. It's just mind-boggling that occurred.
The story behind that and the unraveling of that is really one of the most interesting, I think, in the history of science, because the guy that really first started that was Linus Pauling. And what he did, really, and it doesn't amount to anything more than this, is he took Tinker Toys, kids' Tinker Toys, and modified them so that they would represent what the structure of carbon atoms are. And he just started, like, what would have to happen in order for this structure to work? And he built these huge models and found out and really sort of predicted the structure long before it had been resolved by scientific methods. So, yeah.
I guess what's amazing, you mentioned the DNA molecule, but what amazes me, we know it basically with the genome now, with the DNA, the function of the DNA molecule. But that is, to me, is the formation of DNA.
Right.
In other words, whether it was DNA first or RNA first, but the idea that the formation of the nucleic acids and the fact that they could be designed in such a way that here you have a bundle of molecules that can actually control other chemical reactions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to me, that is absolutely mind-boggling. How that ever occurred. I mean, yeah. Again, going back to what you started out with, the origin of life.
Right.
I mean, the chances, you know, the formation of different molecules and then they're falling apart, the formation again, the falling apart over billions of years.
Right.
And then by happenstance,
right,
that you ended up with a molecule
with those kinds
power.
Of properties.
That's right.
Yeah, that power, right.
Chemical power, if you will. Yeah.
And to pass on genes from one generation to the next. And the fact that we understand that mechanism, I think, attests to the power of the scientific method. But, and I guess one can't help but be humbled by that,
yeah.
Really, in terms of... And really grateful, I think, for the ability that we have to understand it. I mean, you may not even like science, but you have the capacity to understand it and the capacity to appreciate, to unravel it. I mean, that you know, we could have been... very low intelligence people, but we're not. You know, I mean, we could have developed as, and the evolutionary, at this point in time, evolutionary path could have taken a different way, and we might not have the ability or the faculties to understand this. But the fact that we do, I think, is doubly humbling, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, the ordering of the periodic table, I mean, that is just... But the
yeah.
structure of the periodic table itself with each element
being yeah,
that much.
It's interesting that you bring that up. One thing I'd like to point out, though, is that one of the most basic, I think, scientific principles is that the universe tends toward disorder. I mean, it's... One might call it the second law of thermodynamics or the sort of the disorder principle. But the example I like to give college students is because it's so apropos to them, is that let's say you have a dormitory room. And that dormitory room will become completely disordered unless you make an effort to order it. And in all kinds of systems, if we let them go, they will tend to disorder. And it can be proven that that's the case, and it's all tied up with heat and energy and temperature. But despite all of that, despite the basic scientific principle that systems tend towards disorder, we see examples of order all the time. I mean, and one of the classic examples that's being used right now is that you look at sand dunes, for example. There is a randomness associated with the wind and the currents in a desert. But yet you wind up in various places with these highly organized structures of sand. And that's about as random as you can possibly think of, grains of sand. But they will order themselves. Now, a more sort of appropriate example might be the DNA chain. That despite a natural system that would certainly tend toward disorder, you have this... amazing order. I mean, order on a level that we as human beings probably cannot grasp. I mean, we can study DNA, and we do. We know almost everything about it now, but when you step back, that organization, even to the people that work in it, is mind-boggling. And the position of which you're looking at that scientific problem, it goes further and further and further out, but there will still be a point at which you'll have to wonder, how did that all happen, I think. But anyway, you mentioned the periodic table, and it just so happens that that was one of my examples. And I'd like to just show you the first ever published periodic table. And this is from, this is Mendeleev's periodic table in Zeitschrift für Chemie in 1869. And this was a number of years after he had first proposed the periodic law. And what you see here, I don't want to get into huge detail, but just at the top, what I do want to point out is one thing, however, and that is that Mendeleev's scheme, he didn't have anything besides experimental data to organize his periodic chart. He had the identities of the elements, and you can see in various places that there are question marks. He has at various points, and for example, he wasn't sure where gold went, maybe because of the difficulty of getting pure samples, or elements that were extremely difficult to handle, like tellurium, or something like where he had no data at all, elements that turn out to be extremely rare. That he was able to order these things in a way that was remarkably similar to the periodic table that we have today. And he ordered this periodic table purely on the basis of chemical properties, purely on the basis of the fact that, well, these elements had a certain relationship to each other, these elements here had a certain relationship to each other, and so there was sort of a two-way matrix of information that he was embedding in this table. Several years later, he was able to put it into a more coherent form, and that he had groups going down the periodic table, and he mistakenly suggested that there was 12 periodic groups when really there's only 7. But it was not until the 40s, the 1940s that is, that it was possible to show that these groups fit in the middle of these others. And so it was really a remarkable piece of work when you really think about it. Let me just say this too, that he had the composition of various compounds across the periodic table. And this, for chemists, is just absolutely astonishing. That in 1869 or 1875, roughly, without the aid of modern analytical instruments, that he was able to show that the compounds of these various elements that he has designated R, right here, would form compounds like R2O. For example, H2O would be in group 1. CO2 would be in group 4. And so without any sort of modern techniques, just on the behavior of these compounds and these elements with oxygen, he was able to order them in a remarkably wonderful way. The interesting thing about this is that this group out here represents, it has no basis in reality. I mean, all of this is just completely scattered information. He just lumped everything into this last row and said, well, this is what they must do. Because elements like iron and cobalt, nickel and copper have various properties depending on the state that they're in. And so while these elements in here appear to be pretty well behaved, these were ones that didn't, and he just grouped them into this 8th group. But the interesting thing is that despite that, there are 8 main groups in the periodic table. And so what I want to do now is to show you, based on that, this is the modern version of the periodic table.
And I think that's okay.
And there's several very remarkable things about this. Mendeleev's periodic table took this part and this part and gave him his eight groups, sort of the A groups, what we might call 1A, 2A, all the way over to 8A. The rest of it, these ill-behaved elements like iron and cobalt, nickel and copper, manganese, and these other ones wound up being troublesome to him for various reasons. But there's another couple of things that are remarkable about this. Look at how many of the elements in the periodic table are metals. Almost all of them are metals. There's a few right along this boundary right here that are what we call semi-metals. They behave like metals under certain circumstances and behave like semiconductors under other circumstances. But the interesting thing about that, as I said, is how many of these are metals? There's something. The metallic state is the most simple state of matter there is, really, besides gas, of solid matter. These are all so simple. And yet, look at the number of different possibilities that you have. Now, Mendeleev developed his periodic table purely on the basis of experimental data. This periodic table, the modern periodic table, in its current form, can be derived from pure mathematics. And I could do that right now, but I don't have time, and I'm sure you're glad for that. But it's a beautiful example, and usually what I do when I teach this to college students is I spend 2 days, 2 hours, going through and deriving the first three rows of the periodic table from pure mathematics. Now, it's not mathematics that you have to have a degree in mathematics to follow. All one has to do is be able to count to eight, basically. That's all it is. It's all, and the mathematics behind this is one horrendously complicated equation. But it has four simple solutions that are indexed by simple numbers. And all you have to do is believe in those in that solution. It's straight out of a textbook, mathematics that had been developed, the what we call the quantum mechanical model of the periodic table was developed in the 20s with mathematics that had been around for 50 or 60 years. And another remarkable story, I guess, and this, I don't know whether this is related to it or not, but this mathematics, what we call quantum mechanics, was developed in Germany in the 20s in the most turbulent years of that country's existence outside of Nazi Germany, the period leading up to Hitler and Nazi Germany was known, as most people as were aware, as the Weimar Republic, which with unprecedented rates of inflation, political murder, treachery of all kinds, instability in the government, and yet within this time period, agricultural depression, I mean. You listen to the history of this and you wonder how anybody could even live their life in that time period. And yet, the periodic table in this form was derived from pure mathematics. The mathematics to do that was developed in Germany in the 20s. And it's one of the most amazing stories that in science, I think, that ever has come down the pike. But, so, I don't want to dwell on this, but anyway, this is another example that, for me, the fact that you can take something as complex as the periodic table and derive it from pure mathematics tells me, it just points to that larger intelligence. It tells me that there's that intelligence, there's that guiding hand out there that's put this in place. And what a wonderful gift it is, I think, to be able to think about it. That we've been given that gift to understand it. That we've been given the gift to think about it, and that this is one of the things, really, that governs our natural world. It's, you know, one of the very basic fundamentals. And that mathematics can give us that. And I guess that leads, I think, to a question that I have for you. And it is this. Is it a heresy to assume that God's divine intelligence put the world in motion through physical laws of science like the periodic table and left it for us as a problem to solve? Is there something not right about that? Because that's the way I feel about it. I mean, what a wonderful problem to be able to solve. And not only that, but what a wonderful gift to be able to have the ability to solve it. Personally, I could not do that. I don't have the brain power, the mathematical skills to be able to unravel that problem like Schrodinger did in the 20s. But I can appreciate it. I can talk about it. I know where it comes from. And I know the final answer and how to get there. But to do the mathematics, I could have never done that. But yet, to me, it just seems like a wonderful gift, a divine gift, to be able to look at it and think about it and appreciate it in that way. How do you feel about that? Am I way out there somewhere, or what?
May I comment on it, Steve?
Yeah.
When we read our scriptures, I understand it correctly. We say God created heaven and earth, God, and man, and made man a little lower than himself.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, to me, he created the mathematics and physics of control to govern the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
Then he gave man the capability to discover that, but he didn't put any time cap time on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's slow coming through. To me, that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, I guess the problem I have with what you're saying is, you know, I'm not really sure what's in God's mind. So, you know, is it true? Is there some truth in this? We were to discover this?
I don't know.
I think it's an interesting conjecture. I'm thinking of all the other things we don't know, and maybe we will someday. You know, I mean, are we going to get to the bottom of what the black hole is? Maybe we have, but I've never read recently on it. But, you know, or some of the other simple things. I mean, think some of the wonders of nature that I don't know how they happen. I mean, you take a salmon. I mean, it's just remarkable. It just boggles my mind how this salmon that way out in some ocean is going to find the right river and get all the way back to where it was born. And I don't know how big a salmon brain is, but how does it do that? You know, there's got to be an order there. And I'm not sure we've discovered that mystery yet. And maybe it's for us to discover, and maybe we happen upon it. And maybe we were destined to learn it. And maybe it's a quiz to see what we do with the information once we get it. Do we put it to the right use and use it for the betterment of the earth? Or maybe we just happened on it. I mean, I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. I'm not convinced that it was our destiny to do that.
Well, I'm not convinced of that either, I guess. But I guess I can't help but think it.
Yeah.
And maybe when I'm wiser someday, I'll have a different answer. But being a chemist and being so in my work thinking about this so much, I guess one could think on it about it on one level, and that's that it's a wonderfully elegant construction, and that's fine. But for me, there's something more to it than that. There's something, and maybe the question that you're asking about these great, great problems like the salmon in the middle of the ocean getting to the right place at the right time. For me, I guess this, the problem seems complete because you back up and back up and back up, and then you're at pure mathematics. And so the problem seems solved. Because one can derive it from physical laws that really can't be disputed. I mean, in the end, mathematics cannot be disputed, really. I mean, if it's right, you know. We can dispute science all we want to because we'll never know exactly whether the experiment that we chose to do to illustrate the principle is the right experiment, whether, I think we touched on this on the very first day, that we know exactly what the information is that experiment is telling us. But when it comes to pure mathematics, then that's it. You know, it's there, and if the mathematics is consistent, self-consistent, then and I guess one could argue whether the mathematics reflects reality or not, but that's just, I guess, too far out there for me.
Well, but it just seems like each achievement that occurs in science just moves us to another level of understanding. Mm-hmm. It's like a springboard.
Right.
Gregor Mendel, I mean, he had no idea, really, what a gene was.
Right.
But mathematically, he fooled around with it, and he assumed what it was. Charles Darwin, when he worked with evolution, I mean, he didn't know anything about heredity. He didn't know Gregor Mendel.
Right.
And of course, you know, he was right on the heels of Gregor Mendel. But he didn't know them. They didn't communicate with one another.
Right.
Then here comes along Watson and Crick. Now they give us the DNA molecule. Now we move into the genome. Now we say, well, now that we have the genome, now we're going to learn everything there is to know about every gene. Well, that's a little simplistic.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it moves us to another level of understanding.
Right.
That allows us to go ahead a little bit further. So whether we're talking about mathematics or whatever the area of science might be, or homosexuality, or stem cell research, is we are in a new area that maybe the Lord has given us these challenges to work out.
Yeah.
Again, it's a mystery to me, too. I mean, are they presented to us to eventually, I mean, we all ask that question, I would think, where are we going?
Yeah.
You know, Lord, where are you taking us?
Right.
With the periodic table or whatever, the tool, whatever the tool might be.
Right.
Where are we going with these things?
Right.
What do you want us to do with these?
Yeah. Well, I think you're articulating very, very clearly what I was trying to say and mumbling about, of course, but yeah.
And that just reminds me of a wonderful analogy or story I heard once when the theologian who believes that there's a God and the scientist who's not quite sure there's a God, but the answer's on the other side of the mountain, and they have to get to the top of the mountain to look on the other side to see. So the scientist, you know, with his ice pick and all his, you know, tools, climbs and climbs and climbs a mountain, and when he gets to the top, sees the other side, he sees God. But waiting on top of the mountain is the theologian, you know, who sort of knew it all along and said, well, we've just been waiting for you to get here because they had a helicopter and a shortcut and just flew to the top, you know. And I think that's true. Most scientists,
yeah,
you know, the closer they get, the more they see, well, yeah, there would have to be somebody who did all this ordering and understanding.
Yeah. I guess I we're running a little bit late, and so I don't want to keep you, but I guess I would just leave you with what Einstein felt. At the end of his career, he was asked about his achievements and his, I mean, it was very early on, really, when he, most people think that he won the Nobel Prize for the theory of relativity, but he won the Nobel Prize in 1905 for his description of what was called the photoelectric effect, which cemented, really, the relationship between light as a particle nature and light as a wave nature, which was a tremendous achievement, really. But he was asked about his achievements in relativity and the various principles that he helped elucidate, and he said that for all of his life, he felt like he was a boy playing on the shore of the ocean with the pebbles while the whole ocean lay undiscovered before him. And I think, for me, I think that's the way I feel, although the problems that I will address in my life will probably never be as profound as those Einstein looked at. But in the same way, just whether you're doing science or whether you're thinking about science or reading about it, there is that ocean that lies undiscovered, and one, I think, cannot help but to be humbled by that. And it's my hypothesis, or my thesis, I guess, in this week of talk and discussion, that things like the periodic table or the structure of the Earth give us the window onto the Creator, and we are indeed, I think, privileged to have that window. So, tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more about some controversies, but more importantly, I think what I'd like to do tomorrow is come up with a statement of faith about how we view science as people of faith. So, again, thanks for coming, and hopefully we'll see you tomorrow.